for tuning in. This is Henrik Palmgren from Red Eyes Radio. Our website is redeyescreations.com. I hope you had a good week so far. We'll be heading off to the Secret Space Program Conference here in just a few days. Now we'll be heading to San Mateo in California. I hope to see you there, of course. And of course, keep in mind, if you can't make it in person, there will be streaming tickets available so you can catch the event live if you want to as well. The website for that, secretspaceprogram.org, for much more info. Our guest today is Dave McGowan. He was born and raised in Torres, California, just 20 miles south of Laurel Canyon. He graduated from UCLA with a degree in psychology and has since 1990 run a small business in the greater Los Angeles area. He's also been a lifelong music fan who still frequently keeps his radio tuned to classic rock stations. McGowan's previous books include Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murderer, and Understanding the F Word, American Fascism and the Politics of Illusion. We'll discuss his new book today, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. We are going to get into the dark underbelly of the hippie utopia and the military and intelligence services connection to the music scene and the hippie movement that began not in San Francisco, as many believe, but in Laurel Canyon, a small neighborhood in Los Angeles. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Dave McGowan. It's very nice to have you with us. I've heard about your work for quite some time now, so it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I very much appreciate it. And as I was saying off the air, I've heard nothing but good things about you guys. So I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you, Dave. Really appreciate that. Yeah, I'm glad to hear some of our audiences overlapping here as well. That's great to hear. Now, we're going to get into a really interesting topic here today, of course, about your work, your book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. And I thought, as we usually have to do, we have to start a little bit on an outline here, of course. I want to ask you how you got into the topic. It's always interesting to hear how people stumble into some of these things that we talk about on the show. How about you, Dave?
Yeah, it was really just a fluke, as I go into in the preface of the book, because I was actually trying my best to avoid falling into another rabbit hole, you know, at the time that I started this. I went on vacation about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago to, I want to say Hawaii, but I don't remember exactly. But anyway, it was, my wife and I had a trip planned for, early in the year, and my daughter had, gotten me Michael Walker's book, Laurel Canyon, which had been fairly recently released at the time, and which was really the first even mainstream book to really kind of explore this scene. You know, I mean, the story went largely untold for like 40 years nearly, which is kind of odd. But anyway, she had gotten me this book, and I was going off on vacation and, you know, going to be lounging on a tropical beach. And, you know, during my normal day-to-day life, I spend quite a bit of time, you know, digging into dark corners of the conspiracy sphere, so to speak. And I really just wanted to get away from all that. I really just wanted to kind of turn my brain off and just, you know, get away from all the insanity for a couple of weeks and just relax and you know, enjoy my vacation time. And this book seemed kind of like the perfect escapist entertainment, you know. What could be better? What could be further removed from, you know, the conspiracy world than a book about Laurel Canyon? And, you know, this is just going to be very light reading and just, you know, going to bring back all these fond memories of all this great music that I grew up with. And, you know, this is just the perfect light, you know, beach reading. But it didn't turn out that way at all. Instead, what I found was that there were all these little kind of throwaway facts that were in the book that were just sort of presented as kind of asides and sort of largely, you know, interesting, but largely irrelevant facts. And the more of these I stumbled across, the more I realized that there was some very strange things going on behind the scenes with this whole Laurel Canyon scene, and that there seemed to be a whole nother story, a whole nother side to this scene that still remained untold. And so as soon as I got back from that vacation, I just dove headlong into it and started ordering like every book I could find that had ever been written on the scene, every magazine article, web post. I mean, just devouring every written word that I could find on this scene and looking to see if there were more of these little facts that didn't quite seem to fit in with the whole peace, love, and understanding vibe that, you know, was generally associated with that scene. And the deeper I dug, the more I did in fact find. And so I launched it as a web series, with the original intention that it would probably be, you know, just maybe a few posts and sort of an interesting little story. And but as it developed, it just kept snowballing, and you know, the more I dug into it and the more I posted and the more feedback that I got from my readers, you know, the more the story fleshed out, and it just eventually just kind of took on a life of its own and really just really kind of took the internet by storm. And I was just amazed that so many people seemed to resonate with this story, and it seemed to be getting such a wide circulation. And then at some point, I started getting publication offers, and turned the first two down because I just did not get a good feeling about the way that they were going to handle the material. And then eventually got the offer from a Head Press in London, and after a few conversations with them, I kind of got the feeling that we were on the same page and decided to go with them, and now it's become a book. So it's been a very long road. It's been like 7 years that I've since I first started on this. That many years I spent researching and writing the web posts, and then the last couple of years I spent rewriting it all and, you know, trying to fashion it into a book, because one of the problems was that it was kind of written as a work in progress, where I would, you know, write a post about a specific person or event or something, and then I would get feedback from my readers that would tip me off to additional information, and then that would end up getting tucked into a later chapter. And so there was a lot of heavy lifting involved to go through all of this material and do a lot of cutting and pasting and getting all the material so that, you know, everything about one particular person was in one chapter. And so I did all of that and then ended up with this big choppy mess of a manuscript that I then had to go through and spend many, many hours on smoothing out and, you know, providing transitions and whatnot. And then in addition to kind of sweeten the deal for readers, my publisher requested that I write some new material that would be exclusive to the book, and ended up doing a lot more of that than I had originally intended. I think that I wrote 5 new chapters, a new epilogue, and a new preface, and recruited my buddy Nick Bryant to write a foreword.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then, of course, added a table of contents and a bibliography and an index and an acknowledgments page and an author bio page and a dedication and, you know, all these various other parts that make up a book. And after very much hard work, finally turned it into something that actually looks like a book. And So I've got a lot of blood, sweat, and tears invested in this, and so it's been very, very gratifying actually to see, and rather unexpected to see how warmly it seems to be being received.
Right. Yeah.
It's really a little overwhelming actually. I mean, I'm stunned by how many Amazon reviews it's garnered in just 6 weeks, and several glowing online reviews, and you know, I'm getting orders. I'm doing direct marketing, direct sales of signed copies, and I'm getting orders from all over the world. You know, I mean, throughout the English-speaking world, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, England, Ireland, etc., as well as, I mean, places where I never would have expected to get orders from, including Brazil and Germany, Italy, France, Sweden, Norway. I've sent probably 4 or 5 books to Sweden actually.
There you go. Yeah, great.
I'm just, yeah, it's just, I mean, I didn't really fully realize until you know, it came out as a book, that just how much traction this story seems to have gained, and you know, how many people seem to have been aware of it while it was a web series. It's yeah, it's all kind of a whole new world for me, because I'm really not used to getting this much attention and all this praise and all these interview requests and all that. So
well, I mean, it's great. I mean, there's no lack of material to discuss here, certainly, Dave. I mean, it's just a fascinating, you know, compilation of research and everything you pulled together, and the investigations here. And people are hungry for this kind of stuff, too. They're hungry for the truth and unraveling what really has, you know, been happening, how our, you know, past, how our heroes, how our aspirations, how our culture, and all the revolutions and everything else that we think about when we think back, how they have been, you know, shaped and formulated. And of course, this is some of the items we want to get into here today. But I thought first, maybe you can just kind of paint us a picture for those, including myself, who were not alive at the time when all of this started up in L'Oreal Canyon, and what we should actually know about this for those who are completely in the unknown pertaining to this.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people really don't know much about it at all, which is kind of strange, really. I didn't know much about it at all, and I was born and raised in L.A., you know? I mean, I was born in 1960, so I was, you know, I wasn't all that old while this was going on, but I've lived in this town my whole life, and, you know, I know a lot of people in this town, and I never had any knowledge whatsoever that there had been this big, huge music and countercultural scene here, you know, and other people that I know that have lived here their whole life don't either, you know, and the reality is that for the vast majority of people here and probably around the world, when your mind goes to the notion of the hippies and flower children and the whole sort of music and cultural revolution that took place in the 60s, most people's minds go immediately to Haight-Ashbury up in San Francisco, which is almost universally viewed as the birthplace and the sort of home base, you know, spiritual center, whatever you want to call it, of the whole hippie movement.
Yeah.
Which is actually not true, because it actually started right here in LA in Laurel Canyon a couple of years before drifting up north. And, you know, the hippies, so to speak, really first got their footing here in LA. This is where the music revolution began, with the Birds and, you know, the whole folk rock revolution, as well as the hairstyles and clothing styles and attitudes and the whole sort of, you know, what very quickly evolved into what we now know as hippies, all actually began here in LA in Laurel Canyon, before anybody had ever heard of the Haight. And it was a much bigger scene musically by far than what came out of San Francisco. I mean, there was just absolutely an astounding number of bands, hugely influential bands and solo artists that poured out of this canyon in a remarkably short amount of time, from basically like the mid-60s through the mid-70s. You had the Birds, the Buffalo Springfield, the Doors, Love, the Mamas and the Papas, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, the Turtles, the Monkees, the Beach Boys, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, the Eagles, Poco, the Flying Burrito Brothers, and just on and on and on. I never can remember all of them, but just know that I'm leaving out a whole bunch, because there's a lot. And then coupled with that were all the singer-songwriters like James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Judy Sill, Judy Collins, et cetera, et cetera, and various songwriters like Paul Williams and Warren Zevon before he was known as a artist himself. And just absolutely an amazing array of talent that came pouring out of that canyon in a remarkably short period of time. And really, and a lot of these people are to this day these huge cultural icons, you know, like household names, people like Stephen Stills and David Crosby and Frank Zappa and Jim Morrison, and you know, just on. And it's just and most people do not even know that. Most people do not even know the mainstream story of Laurel Canyon, let alone the sort of darker aspects, which my book delves into. So, yeah, it's really a pretty remarkable story that for so many years that even the mainstream version has never really received that much of a telling through the media. So,
yeah.
So I'm trying to correct that to some extent, basically. So I don't even remember what the question was. I probably drifted far off.
No, you're good. It was a little bit more about kind of just setting the stage of what you think we should know about the backdrop of Laurel Canyon. How big of an area are we talking about for those who are not looking at a map currently? Or is it a neighborhood, a small area just within L.A.?
Yeah, we're talking about a very small geographic area. It's not even a city. It's just a neighborhood, you know, one of a number of canyons that slice through from like the west side of LA into the San Fernando Valley. It's kind of these days just basically used as a thoroughfare to get from by a lot of people. That's what I use it for. You know what I mean? I've driven through there hundreds of times before I started this research. Just as another way of getting across town, and never had any inclination that there was, you know, any story to be told there. So yeah, it's a very, very small area and relatively self-contained. You know, I mean, it's not even a city. It's just a neighborhood, like I said, but kind of a self-contained neighborhood in that there's very few ways in and out of there. So it's kind of geographically isolated. It doesn't look or feel much like the rest of LA because it's up in the canyons in this, you know, like heavily wooded, very sort of bucolic, rustic area that doesn't really look a lot like the asphalt jungle that the rest of LA is. And it's sort of self-contained in that they have their own elementary school. They have their own little market. And they at one time had their own talent agency stationed there, and all the record producers moved in there along with the artist. And so you really had kind of this very uniquely self-contained area that was very small. It doesn't, you know, there's not a room for a whole lot of people, and just a shocking proportion of those people during the 60s just happened to be rock stars and their agents and producers and various other hangers on that just basically kind of went in and took over the canyon for a decade or so.
So how do we explain this? Were these all people that they grew up in this area and they lived there all their lives before they became rock stars, or was there amassing of people to the area and because of other reasons? How do we explain this?
Well, yeah, that's one of the unusual aspects. Now, most of them did not grow up here. You know, there were a few that grew up fairly close, but they came from all over the country. A disproportionate number of them seem to have come from the Washington, D.C. area, but they came from everywhere. I mean, from all over the country and even outside of the country. A bunch of them came down from Canada. The guys from Steppenwolf came from Canada, a couple of the guys from Buffalo Springfield, including Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and various others came from Canada. Two of the other guys from Steppenwolf made their way all the way from Germany by way of Canada to get there. The band, the Mamas and the Papas, at the time that this scene started developing, they were down in the Caribbean, cooling their heels on like St. Thomas Island for some reason. And just almost like simultaneously, all of these people from all around the country and literally all around the world just like almost simultaneously converged on Laurel Canyon in the mid 60s. And there was really no logical reason for that to happen at the time. You know, people looking at it now, it seems perfectly natural because LA is now pretty much the music capital of the country. You know, I mean, and this is where you would come if you want to make it.
Right.
But that wasn't true back then. In the mid 60s, New York was still very much the popular music capital of the country. And LA had very little, actually, in the way of either live music or recorded music. It wasn't like a real big music town at all. And the music scene here actually grew up around these artists. So it wasn't the case that the artists came here because this was where the industry was. It was the other way around. The industry came here because this is where all the artists had congregated. So initially, there really wasn't any logical reason to be here for them to be here. But strangely enough, as soon as they arrived, within no time at all, there was a reason to be here because all of these clubs started to pop up like mushrooms all along Sunset Boulevard, the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Roxy, the Troubadour, the Ciro's, Beto Lido's, the London Fog, Kaleidoscope, Pandora's Box, and on and on and on, many of which are long gone and forgotten.
Right.
And so no sooner did these artists arrive than all of a sudden they had venues to play.
Everything was already there, huh? In place.
And then they had record labels, and then they had their own publications. Rolling Stone started publishing like in 67 or something, as did the LA Free Press, right at the mouth of Laurel Canyon. And then they got their own radio station. And it was just remarkable how quickly all of this came together, where before there had been no scene at all. And within like a couple of years, all of a sudden you had all of these artists and all of these clubs and all of these record labels, and they had their own radio station to promote their music and their own publications to promote the music. And it just came together in just an amazingly short amount of time that this whole sort of scene was just built out of nothing.
So God wanted this to happen, right? Because it all came to place in this time at this stage.
I actually have a quote in the book from Neil Young where he says, "I don't really know why us and everybody else went there. We were just like lemmings following the Pied Piper."
Oh, interesting.
That was his quote. You know, I mean, these people couldn't even explain why they were suddenly drawn to Laurel Canyon to answer the Pied Piper's call when, you know, like I say, there was not initially any logical reason why they should be quickly gathering in this one unique spot in LA. So
who's the Pied Piper here, and how do we explain this?
I don't know who the Pied Piper is exactly. But one thing that is very, very odd is that this isolated, rather unusual neighborhood that they chose to camp out in and create this sort of hippie utopia in just happened to house a covert military installation that had been in operation for a very long time and that continued operations at least through 1969 officially. And according to some sources, beyond that, but at least until 1969. So maybe that was the Pied Piper. I don't know, but it's certainly odd that of all the places in the country where they could have all simultaneously arrived to start up this scene, they happened to do it literally clustered around a covert military installation.
In your research here and looking into some of the people that were drawn here, have any of them spilled anything in terms of someone who influenced them or by word of mouth at least said something? Yeah, you need to go there because this is where it's happening. Otherwise, it seems almost like it's a semi-supernatural or mind control-esque type of event where people are just spontaneously drawn there. Is that even possible, do you think?
You know, it's very hard to explain how exactly this happened, how they all arrive there and how they all seem to arrive bearing the same types of folk rock song, the same type of music, like the Mamas and the Papas. They were down in, like I said, they were down in the U.S. Virgin Islands and working in a bar or something, playing as a bar band and writing material and whatnot. And they wrote the album, their first, the Mamas and Papas' first album that, contained the huge monster hits like California Dreamin' and Monday Monday. And, you know, according to the official legend, they wrote that while they were down in the Caribbean, completely isolated from Laurel Canyon and anything else that was going on in the music world. And yet they arrived on the scene with this album's worth of songs that just all happened to be written in the folk rock style that was just then catching fire with the Byrds and Buffalo Springfield and whatnot. And, you know, John Phillips said in his book, he said, I can't really explain how, you know, we just all seem to be on the same wavelength for some reason that I can't really explain. You know, I mean, there's no reason for it because we were cut off completely from what was going on with, you know, this music scene. But yet here we arrived on the scene, you know, just in time to, you know, cash in and just happened to have an album full of songs that fit right in with the rest of what everybody else was writing and recording. So it's very difficult to explain that in any kind of a non-esoteric, conspiratorial sort of way, how that could just happen, that all of these people could not only just arrive there, but also happen to all arrive there with the goal of writing and recording this same kind of music that was, you know, starting to sweep the nation.
Well, indeed, let's definitely get into a little bit later of what kind of music, how this has influenced people, what actually changed during this period. There's a whole slew of very interesting things here, but obviously there's two possibilities. Unless they're not being honest, of course, about how they ended up there and something else is going on here. And the fact is that you found traces, of course, with the band members had family ties to intelligence agencies, military, etc. Is this true in almost all the instances of all the artists and bands that you've been looking at, Dave?
To an overwhelming degree, it is. Yeah, I was stunned that as I dug through these, how many of them that I found that fit the pattern. And yeah, I mean, just like one after another. It's very hard to find someone who played a prominent role in one of the bands who does not come from a intelligence or military, career military type family. You know, beginning with Jim Morrison, whose father was a U.S. Navy admiral, and in fact, the U.S. Navy admiral who was the commanding officer of the ships involved in the Tonkin Gulf incident. So, you know, the father was actually one of the key players who orchestrated this event that led directly to the Tonkin Gulf resolution and the introduction of ground troops and ultimately to hundreds of thousands of American and Vietnamese deaths. And almost simultaneous with that, his son emerged on the Sunset Strip in the Laurel Canyon scene as this sort of icon of the anti-war crowd. You know, so that was a little odd. That was the first one I found. And then as I went through, I discovered that Frank Zappa's dad was a chemical warfare engineer working out, initially assigned to the Edgeward Arsenal. John Phillips' father was a career Marine Corps officer, and his mother, sister, and first wife were all career employees of the Defense Department, Pentagon. All three of the vocalists from the band America were sons of Air Force intelligence officers and actually met and first got together on a U.S. Air Force base. Graham Parsons' father was involved in training Cuban exile groups for the overthrow of Castro, and I think we all know who was financing those operations.
Right.
And, who else? Jackson Browne was born on a military base in post-war Germany to a military officer father. Emmylou Harris was raised on a series of military bases in and around Washington, D.C. Stephen Stills' dad appears to have been some type of a mercenary who was frequently on assignment in various hotspots in Central America. David Crosby's father did naval intelligence work during World War II, as did Peter and James. And it's not just the musicians, but intermingled with them were what were known as the Young Turks, who were the hot Hollywood actors of the time. And and virtually all of them as well.
Do you know why they picked that name, by the way?
Which name?
The Young Turks.
I don't know that. No, I don't.
Because it's been coming up. Obviously, this goes back to the Ottoman Empire. We talked about it recently on one of the programs. That's why I ask it. And it's just interesting that it echoes back in this kind of way. But yeah, well, if you don't know more about the background on that, that's definitely fine. But how do we, I mean, we have all these connections to military establishments and you know, intelligence people, you know, everything is happening at the same time. It's coming together at the same spot. Everything is in place for this to be released. It's obviously very difficult to come to another conclusion that the agenda here was to create something for the purposes of bringing this to the rest of the world. How did you deconstruct this when you were going through this, Dave, in terms of what the purposes was of the music and the style, the, you know, from the clothing to the attitudes to the way people talked? We'll get into the drug aspect later as well, of course. But was this all by design manufactured out of the small territory in LA?
I believe it was, yeah. And I believe the goal was specifically to put one of the goals at any rate. There was probably more than one goal being pursued, but one of the key goals, I believe, was to put a very a face on the anti-war movement that would be very distasteful to mainstream America. And you know, that's another great misconception about the 60s. You know, one of the great misconceptions is that Haight-Ashbury was the birthplace of the hippie movement, which isn't actually true. Another one that's very widely held is that the hippies were basically synonymous with the anti-war movement. Most people think of them as being one and the same. And that's not actually the case. The anti-war movement actually preceded the hippies. And it began on college campuses and being promoted by very straight-laced, clean-cut, you know, rather conservative college professors and their equally clean-cut students. And that quickly changed when the hippies came along. And I have quotes from people in the book saying, "Where the hell did these hippies come from? Where,
right.
How did this happen?" You know, there very clearly was an anti-war movement that preceded the hippies, and that had a much more professional face on it, so to speak. And I believe it was a deliberate ploy to. I have a lot of affinities with the hippies. You know, I mean, I was born in 60. I grew up in the 70s, but I always kind of felt like I should have been a hippie that just, you know, had the misfortune of being born 10 years too late, you know? but the reality is the face of the hippie movement was very offensive to the vast majority of, you know, mainstream America. You know, I mean, from the hairstyles and the clothing styles to the music to the free love and free sex and the open drug use. And I mean, everything about them, just whether by design or not, and it certainly seems like it, everything about them really was distasteful to, you know, people in the heartland and whatnot, you know, the Bible belters and what have you. I just couldn't imagine a more distasteful face to put on the anti-war movement in a lot of people's minds than the hippies. So,
right.
I believe very much that was absolutely one of the chief goals. And so, ironically enough, you know, the very people that a lot of folks think of as sort of spearheading and driving the anti-war movement may very well have been put in place to impede the anti-war movement, you know. And there's this mythology that the hippies stopped the Vietnam War, which is decidedly untrue, you know. The Vietnam War drug on into what, not like 1973 or something. I mean, even after like four students were gunned down at Kent State in 1970, you know, the thing still drug on for two or three more years. You know, so this notion that the hippies somehow stopped the war is just simply not true. And I believe that they did, in fact, serve to actually prolong the war.
Really? Well, that's interesting. Now, tell us a little bit more about some of the origin points that you've pinpointed here. We have a couple of people showing up here, of course, but V2, Paulekas, I think you pronounce his name. Tell us more about this character and how he plays into the picture here.
I had a lot of trouble digging up anything on him, and I never heard of the guy, never heard of the name. And in fact, the first several references to him that I came across in the various materials that I was reading, and he would mostly just be sort of referenced in passing, just sort of a passing reference to this guy. And I just skipped right over him initially because I'm like, who is this guy? I've never heard of him. And, you know, he's just sort of mentioned as a peripheral character. He's not that important. And so I just skipped over it. But then I kept finding more and more references to the guy. And I eventually decided, well, there's got to be something here. This guy's got to be more important than I initially thought because he seems to just keep popping up everywhere. And so I started digging into it and eventually got in touch with a family member who provided me with a lot of inside information that had not previously been posted anywhere. And sort of fleshed out this story of this guy who though unknown to the general public, appears to have been one of the guys, if not the guy, who first spearheaded the whole hippie movement. His wife opened up the first clothing boutique that started offering hippie fashions, you know, what became known as hippie fashions. And he ran this dance troupe. He had this group of mostly young girls, mostly young and attractive girls, very Manson-esque, actually. And he was a very popular guy because he always had a lot of very young, attractive, and ready and willing girls around him. So he was a very popular guy to have around. And he was basically treated as royalty by the clubs who let him and his troupe in for free. And they would go out to the clubs and create this big spectacle on the dance floor while the bands were playing, and sort of by doing so really introduced the hairstyles and the fashions and the dance styles and whatnot that came to define the hippie movement. And but he's largely a forgotten figure. I mean, you won't find much about him unless you dig pretty deeply, but he appears to have been a very, very key player in really creating this whole, and I have quotes from people all over the book saying, yeah, these guys, they were the first hippies. They were the very first hippies. They were the ones that started it all, and they were the ones that the club owners wanted in their clubs because they drew the crowds. And these, they really served kind of a couple of purposes. Number one of which is that they were one of the key people who first drew the people out to the clubs. As I mentioned before, these clubs were all pretty much newly opened. They did not have an established clientele and were largely unknown to the public, as were all of these bands. You know, nobody knew who the Doors or Love or Mom, you know, nobody knew, right, who these people were. Yeah. And what really started getting people out to the clubs and put these bands on the map were, to a large extent, the Freaks, because their appearances were heavily promoted, and people wanted to come out and see this bizarre spectacle that was taking place on the dance floor. And along with that were the Young Turks, once again, who were also very widely reported to be regularly attending these clubs, regularly cruising Sunset Strip on the weekends and dropping into these clubs. And so it became pretty well known that you could actually go to these clubs and literally rub shoulders with, like, Sharon Tate or, you know, Jane Mansfield or Peter Fonda or Jack Nicholson or Bruce Dern or all of these other people. And so the thing that, and I have quotes from the band members themselves and family members and their producers and managers even, who readily admit that the initial attraction was not the bands. The people were coming out to see this spectacle going on the dance floor, to see these celebrities mingling with the commoners and all of these quote unquote freaks, you know, showing up and dressing and dancing in a way that nobody had ever seen before. I mean, it was just like, you know, out of this world at the time. And that's what really initially put these clubs and these bands on the map. That's what got the crowds out there and established a name for these bands. And it's also what distracted a lot of attention away from the stage and the fact that, and this never really goes over well with a hardcore 60s rock fans. But,
I think nothing of this does.
Away from the fact that a lot of these bands were just not that good initially. Again, there's numerous quotes in the book attesting to that, that initially at least, a lot of these bands were just not that good, which is why their albums were largely recorded by studio musicians. And, you know, they didn't have that benefit when they were on the stage. And so, you know, that was a key element of distracting attention away from the fact that the music coming from the stage may not have been all that it could be. So,
Well, those two groups,
the Freaks and the Young Turks, were really instrumental in building this awareness and building an audience for this whole scene. And Vito Pelegas, one other thing that I should probably throw out there is that he just happened to be related by marriage to the Rockefeller family.
Coincidental, just, obviously.
Yes, because you know when you think hippies, you think Rockefellers, right? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, it's synonymous at this stage, right?
Oh, absolutely. They go together hand in hand. Yep. So it's perfectly natural that, you know, he would be related by marriage to the Rockefeller clan. So every one of these people has some kind of dark connection in their past. I mean, it's just absolutely uncanny. You know, Bruce Dern had an uncle that was Skull and Bones, you know, and his godparents were Adlai Stevenson and First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, I mean, he came from a very politically connected family, you know. Dennis Hopper admitted before he passed away that his father was a career intelligence operative that began with the OSS and continued on with the CIA, you know. Sharon Tate's father, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tate, is U.S. Air Force intelligence. And just on, I mean, it's just absolutely uncanny how many of these people were direct products of the military intelligence community, and then they just happened to gather around a covert military intelligence facility to start up the hippie movement, you know, which doesn't make it sound like it was all that organic, grassroots sort of a movement. You know, I mean, we're supposed to look at this as sort of a grassroots organic response to the war and to the prevailing social conditions. But the more you look at it, the less organic it gets.
I want to ask you more about the music itself than how you believe that was made. Actually, you talk about studio musicians, et cetera, because there's something. I've always wondered if there was something by design in the music itself. What's interesting here, as you already noted, is how similar so much of the style was. It was like ready out of the package. Certainly there was progression. Things happened. It evolved in a certain way. And they, you know, bands later on took on, you know, different sounds and stuff like that. But it's very homogenous. It's like ready. It's right out of the package, almost, you know, day one kind of thing. So do you think that there's been a lot of effort and conscious planning going into the music itself, the lyrics perhaps, or was the musicians very much kind of free to reign however they wanted to put this together?
That's difficult to say. I mean, there was certainly a very strong similarity between the music that the different bands were putting out, and part of that was because a lot of it was being played by the same musicians.
Right. Yeah. You know,
I have a quote somewhere from a somewhat contemporary drummer, not a really well-known guy. I think he was like the drummer for Toto or something. I don't know. But he had a quote where he said that he was devastated to discover that his 10 favorite drummers of all time were actually all the same guy.
Because, really?
There was a band, a group of studio musicians known as the Wrecking Crew. That was comprised of Hal Blaine was the drummer. Glenn Campbell was actually the lead guitarist, believe it or not. Leon Russell was the keyboard player. Carol Kay was the bassist, and various others who were just considered to be the cream of the crop. I mean, absolutely the best studio musicians working, and they were in very, very high demand. And they are actually the reality is that a lot of the albums that people revere to this day, so at least the early work of a lot of these bands, was not recorded by the people pictured on the cover. It was recorded by the Wrecking Crew.
Wow.
The Birds did not play, other than Jim McGuinn. Jim McGuinn was the only one of the Birds who actually played on their first couple albums. It was, mostly studio musicians. And one of the things that kind of catches people by surprise is when I throw out the name Monkees, you know, along with these other bands, and they're like, why are you treating the Monkees as if they were a real band? You know, it was a TV show. And, but the reality is that they were very much accepted as a part of the musical community. And if you look through pictures from that era, you can see, like pictures of Mickey Dolenz, for example, hanging out in Mama Cass's front yard and jamming with Eric Clapton and David Crosby, you know. And most people would be like, well, what is he doing there? He's an actor. He just played a musician, you know. But that's not the reality. The reality is that they were very much accepted as peers. Their homes in Laurel Canyon were very popular gathering spots, and they were very much integrated into the Laurel Canyon scene. And the reason for that, in large part, I believe, is because the bands knew something that the general public did not, which was that the actual musicians playing on the Monkees records were the very same musicians who played on the Birds' initial records, and on the Mamas and the Papas, and on the Turtles, and on the Beach Boys. The same people provided were playing. I mean, these guys were supposed to just be absolutely crack musicians that could just pretty much play anything they were asked to and get it in one or two takes. You know, they're just phenomenal. They were arguably the most talented musicians on in the Laurel Canyon Sunset Strip scene, and yet are completely unknown pretty much to the general public. And I think it would shock a lot of people to find out that the guitarist that they admire on some of these records was the Rhinestone Cowboy, Glenn Campbell, of all people, you know? So there was a very synthetic nature to a lot of this music, you know, particularly with the Birds, you know? I mean, when these guys got together, and they're the ones that kickstarted the whole folk rock revolution, the first band signed, the first album released, you know, the one that really got the ball rolling with, what was their first release? Mr. Tambourine Man, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Mr. Tambourine Man. And the reality is that the Birds, the five members of the Birds, David Crosby, Jim McGuinn, Chris Hillman, Michael Clark, and Gene Clark, had very little to do with the creation of those first couple of albums. Most of the music were written by folk stars, so Bob Dylan. I think Bob Dylan's songs made up like half their first album or something.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And Pete Seeger and various other people. So these albums were basically created by taking other people's songs, having it performed by unnamed studio musicians, and then basically having the members of the band go in the studio and overdub their vocals on top of it. Wow. And that's how, you know, so the notion that these guys, you know, pioneered that sound just doesn't really add up, because they had very, very little involvement in, other than McGuinn. McGuinn was regarded as a very, very skilled 12-string guitarist, and he did play his own parts on the albums. But the guy drafted to play bass, Chris Hillman, had never played a bass guitar in his life. He was a bluegrass mandolin player. So why in the world would you cast a... And I use the word cast very deliberately.
Right, yeah.
Why would you cast a bluegrass mandolin player to play the part of the bass player in the world's first folk rock band?
Right.
You know? I mean,
yeah.
It's not like there weren't a lot of musicians milling about the scene by that time. You know, why why him? You know, and then the drummer, this Michael Clark, never played drums in his life. He was a bongo player. You know, so two of the whole rhythm section of the band had no clue how to even play their instruments when they joined the band. They'd never even played their instruments in their life, the entire rhythm section, you know? And then you had Clark and, Gene Clark and Crosby, who could play guitar passably, but not really well enough to, you know, perform in the studio or whatnot. So there was really only one guy out of the five who was actually had any kind of proficiency on his instrument when the band first got together. And yet these were the guys who set off this entire musical revolution, you know? So the more you look at it, the more contrived it all really seems, you know? And then the speed with which these bands came together was just absolutely remarkable, you know? I mean, they had recording contracts and they were in the studio and playing the clubs in an amazingly short amount of time, you know? I mean, this wasn't when you think of this as sort of a grassroots scene, you think of something that develops kind of slowly with, you know, these struggling artists, you know, trying to get contracts and, you know, hoping maybe they'll get a little bit of play on college radio and, you know, eventually work their way up to doing something. There wasn't any of that. I mean, these people arrived and within like weeks in some cases, they had recording contracts. They were provided with instruments, with a rehearsal space, with, recording space. And it was just absolutely remarkable how quickly these bands came together and were put on the cultural map, despite the fact that a lot of them did not initially have the musical skills. Wow. Mamas and Papas, another classic example, you know, I mean, there wasn't really a real musician in the entire band. Cass and Denny Doherty, who really carried the band because they were phenomenally talented vocalists, but neither of them were musicians. And Michelle Phillips wasn't a vocalist or a musician. She was just up on the stage to look pretty. I mean, right. That was the only, yeah. You know, and John Phillips was a fairly good composer, but he wasn't much of a vocalist and he was only a passable guitarist. So, they didn't play any of their music, you know, so. There was a lot of that, a lot of reliance on studio musicians and, especially in during the earliest, some of them did eventually, you know, develop into very, respected, musicians and whatnot, but initially a lot of them, were not really qualified to be elevated into these positions that they quickly found themselves in.
Wow, very fascinating, Dave. Let's take a short break here in a little bit and continue to talking more about this. Time's just flying by here. There's so much I want to ask you, but obviously there's just so much more to the cultural revolution I can't think of calling it anything else. How this was started, you know, the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll scene, and why this was done, and we'll get deeper into some of these questions as well. But before we break, though, let's give out some of the details about where people can find more information about the book, where they can pick up copies. Of course, you have your own website, Center for an Informed America. Maybe you can give us the URL for that, Dave, and so people know where to go to read more about you and your work.
Yeah, I am. I'm offering them for direct sale on my website, doing my best to compete with Amazon, which isn't easy because, man, those people are cutthroat over there.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
But, yeah, God, they just they make it really hard for anybody to make a buck off a book anymore, you know. It's just ridiculous. But anyway, my website is, the Center for an Informed America, which is at www.davesweb.cnchost.com, which is kind of a mouthful, but if you Google my name, either Dave or David McGowan, it's generally about the first link that comes up. So if it's easier to find it that way. And when you get there, you will see various images of the book cover. And if you click on any of those, it will take you to the page that I have set up for direct orders. And I also set up a few months ago a Facebook page for the book, which is at www.facebook.com/ Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, all written as one word with no spaces, no capitalization, no punctuation. Or if you just go to Facebook and search for Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, I'm sure it's very easy to find. And I believe it's a publicly accessible page the way I set it up, although I don't really know that much about social media, but I don't think you need to be specifically a member of the Facebook generation to get on there. And that is where I am keeping all the updates about my upcoming interviews, appearances, information, links back to my website to buy the books, any reviews that are posted I put up there, and all the pictures, a bunch of visuals for those who want to have the visual component to go along with the book. I have all kinds of my own original and vintage photographs of the people and places that played key roles in all of this. So that's sort of the central gathering spot for where I put up any new information about anything that's going on with the book.
All right, very good. The website again here, davesweb.cnchost.com, and do try to buy the book through Dave's website and avoid Amazon. We won't link to that in this case here because, you're right, absolutely. We got to try to get off Amazon.
You can go over there and read my reviews, though. I'm getting rave reviews, which I'm just, I'm just thrilled with the response that I'm getting from Amazon, although not so thrilled with their pricing policies, but
so they buy wholesale from your publisher or something and then offer it to, or how do they do that?
I don't know how they work. They obviously operate on a very, very small profit margin because they're moving a massive quantity of goods, so yeah. They can operate on very, very like almost non-existent profit margins and basically undercut everybody else. They're very, very, they've done a fine job of destroying brick and mortar bookstores. I mean, LA used to be full of them, there were all kinds of big chains like Borders and Barnes and Nobles and Scribner's and Pickwick and all kinds of them, which all seemed, and all the local mom and pop. I mean, you cannot hardly find a new bookstore in LA anymore. There's used bookstores that are still surviving selling used books, but the new book market is, Amazon controls just a massive portion of it these days.
That's why their new tablet is called Kindle Fire. It's about book burning, so it's actually really symbolic why they named it that.
It's very appropriate.
Yeah, it sure is. The other one I wanted to give out here as well then is the Facebook page, simply facebook.com/weirdscenesinsidethecanyon. Check that out, folks, and follow along in the regular updates by Dave there as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break with much more.
Winds of change blow round my door. Is this the year I've been waiting for? Worlds in motion endlessly. Cosmic ocean flows into my heart of me. Would like to be a shining lighthouse for all to see. When the dark night hides the sun, shine a light for everyone to see. Isn't that the way it should be? I am no stranger to a world of change. There are always situations to rearrange, but there's some special about this quiet dawn. It seems to sing a song to everyone. It's dawn and on and on and on. Change are here at last. The clouds are lifted, the storm has passed. Nights we've known are on the run. a bright and shining sun for everyone to see. The winds of change